Hello, and welcome to We Bought a Cabin in the Woods. My name is AJ.
And I'm Ryan, and today we're going to be talking about Psycho. AJ, what are your thoughts on the movie Psycho?
So, Psycho is one of my all-time favorite movies. It is not my favorite Hitchcock movie, only because I love Rear Window, but it is my number two. It is a defining movie in helping me begin to fall in love with the horror genre. I basically didn't watch horror movies until I was in college, and I took a class about Hitchcock, and we watched Psycho. And it kind of helped me get my foot in the door to begin watching horror movies. And so I really do credit this movie with helping me fall in love with the genre as a whole. And then on top of that, it's extremely influential. Well, what are your kind of opinions about the movie overall?
So yeah, one of my main opinions about this movie is that it's a great movie for people to jump into the horror genre, because basically this movie, like AJ said, is extremely influential on many, many movies we're going to talk about in the future. Alfred Hitchcock, as we'll probably talk about in a little bit, was known as the master of suspense, and he is very good at setting up this mind twist of a movie and getting it onto the screen. So if you're a beginner in the horror genre or you haven't seen Psycho, you probably should jump in and watch it at some point, because it's definitely one of the most spoken to movies in the horror genre. It's still a good movie. It holds up so well, even though it's what, like almost 50 years old, almost 60?
It's 58 years old. So the movie was released in 1960, and here we are talking about in 2018, and it is still one of the most vitally important horror films ever made.
Absolutely.
So,
and it could be argued it's one of the, you know, most influential movies in modern movie making history, right? I mean,
yes, I believe that people will grow in a greater appreciation for this film. It really, like you said, created the first modern horror film. It changed a lot of the conventions, and then because of that, we're now in a golden age of horror movies in 2018. And so we decided this is the movie that you have to start with to kind of understand horror genre as a whole, and then move from there. All right. So, with all that said, some people may not have ever seen the movie Psycho. We're going to do a quick rundown of the plot of the movie. This will catch everybody up on what actually occurs in the movie and kind of refresh your memory in case it's been a while since you've seen the movie. If you want to hear spoilers about the movie, the synopsis that we're about to read off will give you those spoilers. If not, you might want to put this podcast on pause and come back to it later after you've watched the movie. Or at least jump ahead a little bit so you can begin to get a lot of these things. Now, here's the thing, is that this movie, because it is 58 years old, I kind of don't feel very bad about people who have not seen it at this point. I'll be 100% honest.
Yeah.
You are this far behind on a movie. I don't think you're exempt from spoiler warnings anymore, but I wanted to give one anyway just in case.
No, absolutely. And the biggest thing is that we're going to be talking a lot about the history of the movie itself. So there's going to be a lot of really cool information that you might want to hear watching the movie for the first time to get a better appreciation, especially if you're used to modern horror or if you're used to modern movies. It might feel dated and weird if you don't know the history of how this movie came to be and the trials and tribulations that had to go into creating this movie.
Okay, so we are going to go ahead and put in the show notes where we are talking about the plot of this movie, and then that way you can just pick back up after we've already discussed the overall plot of Psycho. I already told you I don't feel sorry for you, but I'm going ahead and giving it to you anyway. All right, Ryan, so go ahead and kick us off. What is the plot of Psycho?
A camera looks over the skyline of Phoenix, Arizona. It slowly zooms into a window, and we see Marion Crane and Sam Loomis having taken a long lunch to sleep together. Marion pressures Sam to marry her, but both lament they have no money.
Marion returns to work when her boss brings in Tom Cassidy, a man who has brought $40,000 in cash to buy his daughter a house. Quick note, $40,000 in 1960 was worth about $315,000 today.
That's a pretty good home.
Yeah. Marion's boss tells her to take the money to the bank, and Marion asks if she can go home early for the day after dropping off the money. Instead of going to the bank, Marion goes home, packs her bags, and steals the money. But on her way out of town, her boss spots her.
The next morning, a cop wakes Marion on the side of the road. Has she already been reported to the police? She immediately tries to drive away, suspicious of from the officer. In the next town, she goes to the used car salesman and tries to buy a new car to divert suspicion. She pays $700 in cash and trades in her car. The officer is still following her, but he lets her go and talks to the used car salesman.
That night, Marion decides to pull over and sleep due to the heavy rain. She sees the Bates Motel and makes a stop. She sees a woman in the window and honks to get the attention of the owners. Out comes Norman Bates. He asks if she'd be willing to join him for dinner, and she agrees. While she changes, she hears Norman and his mother arguing. She hides the money in a newspaper and goes to join Norman for dinner.
Norman explains his hobby of taxidermy to Marion, and the two begin to discuss stuck in a situation you don't want to be in. Norman is born into his relationship with his mother. Marion won't let on what she's done, but she acknowledges it was her own doing. Marion suggests that Norman put his mother in a home, and the two have a verbal spat. Marion apologizes and realizes her mistake. She'll drive back to Phoenix and take responsibility for the theft.
Marion leaves for the night, and she calculates what she'll owe. She throws away the scraps of paper into the toilet. Little does she know, Norman is watching through a peephole in the wall. He stops and heads upstairs. Marion turns on the shower and begins to enjoy it. It's as if she's washing away the guilt of her theft. However, the door behind her opens, and the shadowy figure of a woman walks through the door. 52 seconds later, Marion Crane has been stabbed. She falls half out of the bathtub. The figure disappears, and we hear Norman scream about blood. He runs downstairs and finds Marion Crane dead.
Norman quickly cleans up the bathroom in the room. He takes down the shower curtain and puts Marion in the liner. He mops the blood and washes away any blood spatters. He puts Marion, her clothes, and the newspaper full of money into the trunk of the car. He sinks the car in the marshlands.
A few days later, Lilla Crane goes to Sam Loomis. She wants to know if Marion is with him. He tells her no, and a private investigator named Arbogast enters the room. Arbogast has been hired by Tom Cassidy, the man with the money. He goes door-to-door throughout the town, questioning about Marion. He comes to the Bates Motel and meets Norman. The two talk, and things seem off to Arbogast. He calls Lila and lets her know that he believes that something is off with Norman. He'll be at Sam soon, but he wants to see if he can ask Miss Bates some questions first.
Sam enters the Bates house. It is quiet, and there's no sign of Norman. He walks up the stairs to question Mrs. Bates. When a woman runs out of the room and stabs Arbogast in the chest, he falls down the stairs and the figure follows him down, stabbing him to death. Lila and Sam are worried something has happened, and Sam goes to investigate. There's no sign of Arbogast.
Sam and Lila contact the local sheriff to find out what happened. They report their suspicions, but the sheriff rebuffs them. Not only is Norman alone, but Mrs. Bates died 10 years ago.
Lila and Sam don't believe the story and go to the Bates Motel themselves. The two of them pretend to be married couple to fool Norman. They realize that the room number one is where Marion was, and while Norman is in the office, they sneak in. They find a piece of paper proving Marion was there and devise a plan. Sam will distract Norman while Lila investigates the house. While Sam and Norman talk, Lila makes her way up to the house.
There's no sign of Mrs. Bates. Her belongings are out, but she is nowhere to be seen. She hears a commotion and sees Norman running up towards the house. She hides under the stairs, where she finds the stairwell to the fruit cellar. Lila walks down the stairs and finds Mrs. Bates. However, when Lila turns Mrs. Bates around, she finds a mummified skeleton. Norman enters the room with a knife. Dressed in women's clothing, he comes to stab her, but Sam appears at the last minute, stopping Norman from another murder.
At the police station, a psychologist tells Sam and Lila and the police what happened. Norman has a split personality due to his dependence on Miss Bates. Over the past 10 years, Norman's psychological break has caused Miss Bates' portion of his psyche to gain more control. Norman's Mrs. Bates' personality admits to the murders of Crane, Arbogast, and the two other missing girls. The psychologist also contends that the supposed murder-suicide that killed Mrs. Bates and her lover were actually the work of Norman. We see Norman one last time, but Miss Bates has taken over the narration. Norman takes one dastardly look into the camera, and as his face fades away, the skull of Miss Bates takes its place.
All right, so one of the things that we do have to talk about, though, before we get into the history of Psycho as a movie, is kind of about where movies were at in the 1950s and kind of America as a whole. First, 1959 was actually a pretty important year for film as a whole. One of the big movies to come out that year was Some Like It Hot. It was a huge box office sensation. It starred Marilyn Monroe, Jack Lemmon. It had two men cross-dressing in a comedy. It was one of the first times that that was kind of seen on screen. Another big movie that came out that year was Anatomy of a Murder, which is about a trial, but the audience never actually sees the crime itself. So you, as the audience, are basically part of the jury in the case, and you have to decide whether or not you think the defendant is guilty or not. It was super revolutionary at the time, and these were new things that are being tried in cinema. Up to this point, movies were point A to point B, pretty straight, linear storytelling. Now movies were beginning to challenge that. And another big thing was that horror movies at the time were super, well, not respected. And what were some of the reasons for that?
Some of the horror movies that were going on right now were gimmicky, and there was like a creature that escaped the screen, and then they had buzzers buzzing under your seat, and they were just very gimmicky and kind of silly and fun, and mostly, I guess, for children. Another one, they had a glow-in-the-dark skeleton pop up from behind the screen and slide down. And everyone knew the skeleton was coming, so they'd all throw stuff at the skeleton. So just absurd things that we would never see in modern cinema were going on with these very gimmicky horror movies. And one of the things that was happening is these foreign films were sort of coming out at the time that were kind of pushing the envelope and pushing the censors. And there hadn't been any big director that has come because, like AJ said, horror has always been this kind of side category in cinema. So that's kind of where Alfred Hitchcock kind of came in and revolutionized the genre as a whole.
Yeah, one of the cool things about Psycho is that it kind of is so iconic that it completely distorts how people view Alfred Hitchcock. A lot of people view him as a horror movie director or as a director who made a lot of scary movies. And a lot of that is because of this movie and the Birds that he'll make in 1963. However, Hitchcock mostly just dealt with your traditional crime movies. They weren't horror films like this one ended up becoming. And so there weren't very many well-renowned directors that were working in this medium or in the genre. And that ended up really changing the game when Alfred Hitchcock chooses to jump in. And another thing that was really important at the time was kind of the 1950s. We hear the phrase "Make America Great Again" a lot. That's kind of what people believe that America should be like.
Yeah, so we have the whole movement of the Americana movement, which is, you know, this very private, conservative American family that has this very nuclear base. You know, the whole father knows best, you know, mentality that we sort of have at this time.
I mean, there was literally there was a show called Father Knows Best.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? Oh, goodness. So, I mean, I don't know if this was the time period where they had the two separate beds in is Leave It to Beaver. Yeah, was that the show?
Yeah, Leave It to Beaver is one of the shows that is at its absolute peak during this time period.
Yeah.
And just when you think back to traditional Americana, like high school kids hanging out, basically the movie Grease,
yeah,
people are not super edgy yet,
yeah,
but it's starting to seep its way into society.
No, absolutely.
People are starting to kind of break those conventions, and that's all happening at the end of the 1950s.
Yeah, so as you rewatch this movie or watch this movie for the first time, kind of put that in to your perspective of what this movie was doing. And one of the reasons I love horror personally is that it's constantly pushing the envelope, pushing the censors. I mean, the movie opens up with the implied sex between Marion Crane and Sam, you know?
Yeah.
That's and edgy at that time.
and one of the crazy things about it is that Marion Crane is in a brassiere.
Yeah.
Which had never really been shown in a film before. Women were very covered up.
Interesting.
Marion Crane is one of the first characters ever in film history to show her belly button.
Wow.
That's how conservative films were. Like, yeah, if you think back to the Annette Funicello movies of the 1950s, she's wearing a bathing suit, but her belly button is covered, and she's wearing, like, a longer top, and so there's very little skin being shown.
Interesting.
And the other cool thing about this movie is that it opens with that sex scene, with a post-sex scene.
Yeah.
And the movie that immediately precedes this in Hitchcock's filmography is North by Northwest, which ends with the implied start of a sex scene.
Interesting.
They are start making out in a train, and then the train goes into a tunnel, and that's how the movie ends. It is the least subtle metaphor you could possibly imagine.
That's awesome.
And then his very next movie begins with two characters after the act of having sex. So that was pretty groundbreaking in its own right.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But
speaking of Alfred Hitchcock, let's kind of talk about him as a person, because he is such an important figure in this entire movie being made.
So yeah, Alfred Hitchcock was born in 1899 in Leamington Stone. Is that – I don't know.
Leytonstone,
Essex. So he started in the industry in 1919 as a title card designer. His first feature film was The Pleasure Garden in 1925, and it flopped.
Of course.
His first thriller was The Lodger, A Story of the London Fog, in 1927, and it was a film that followed a serial killer murdering women that was based on Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, you can actually watch that movie today if you want to. It is on YouTube, and it's available on a couple different streaming platforms. It is a silent film, just as a heads up, but it does kind of inform you about a lot of his influences early on in his life. It's cool. It also has a weird bluish hue to it, but that's okay.
Yeah. And then he married Alma Reveal. As you can tell, I'm really bad at names. So
it's okay.
In 1926, who helped edit many of his films. A film critic called Charles Champlin once noted that the Hitchcock touch had four hands. Two were Alma's. So he had a very, very close relationship with his wife. I think the best like moment is when he accepted that award. That whole quote that he has.
He later wins his Oscar. Mm-hmm. It's an honorary Oscar. He never wins one in competition.
Mm-hmm.
And when he wins it, he dedicates it to his wife. And it is amazingly cute. And it really does tell you how much he loved his wife.
Yeah.
The 39 Steps is his next film in 1935, and it kind of introduces the concept of the MacGuffin. Now, MacGuffins are pretty popular and often misunderstood in film, so let's kind of talk about what it is. Now, the concept was introduced by Angus MacPhail. It's an item or goal the protagonist is pursuing, one that otherwise has no narrative value. Now, over time, it's kind of changed a little bit, but it is the ultimate goal of a character. And it can be personified or visualized through a single item. So one example of this is R2-D2 in A New Hope.
Mm.
A lot of the movie kind of is premised on the fact that everybody's trying to get this droid because it might or may not have plans for the Death Star. But then it's through that that we're able to create all the action around it that ends up becoming the actual story. Another example could be the Pulp Fiction suitcase, or even Infinity Stones in the new Marvel movies could be considered a MacGuffin. So MacGuffins are important to the characters in some way, but may not actually be important to the narratives that we end up following. And a MacGuffin is really important in the context of Psycho, which is why we kind of had to take a minute to talk about it.
Cool.
He'll make The Lady Vanishes in 1938, and then the success of that movie allows David O. Selznick to sign a deal with him. Now, Selznick is best known for making A Star Is Born, the original version, as well as Gone with the Wind. So he's one of the biggest producers in all of Hollywood, and he says, hey, we got to sign this guy up. And immediately, this begins to pay dividends, because Alfred Hitchcock's next film, Rebecca, wins Best Picture. It starred Laurence Olivier, it won a bunch of Oscars. Hitchcock did not win an Oscar, but it was his first of five nominations. He also makes Suspicion in 1941, Shadow of a Doubt in 1943, Notorious in 1946, and Strangers on a Train in 1951.
Yeah, so his peak, I mean, a lot of you have probably heard about some of these movies. So Dial M for Murder used some of the 3D cinematography for Rear Window in 1954. To Catch a Thief in 1955, Vertigo in 1958. That one won Sight and Sound poll for best film of all time in 2012. North by Northwest, which is, isn't that like his biggest movie, is the North by Northwest there?
North by Northwest was his biggest film until Psycho.
Okay.
It was a huge box office sensation. It starred mm-hmm. Cary Grant. It starred Eve Marie Saint. It was a huge hit.
Mm-hmm.
And so Alfred Hitchcock is writing his absolute peak, especially when you look back at it and to know from 1954
yeah.
to 1963, mm-hmm. he releases Dial M with Murder, Rear Window, Vertigo, North by Northwest, Psycho, and The Birds
yeah.
in a 10-year span. Those are arguably like 5 or 6 of the greatest 100 films ever made.
Yeah.
He did them all in 10 years.
Pretty
That's
incredible.
Insane.
No, absolutely. And then, of course, he has the Alfred Hitchcock Presents, which began in 1955. Is that still streaming? I know it was streaming on Netflix for a while.
You can
I don't
still
know.
Stream Alfred Hitchcock Presents.
Okay, great.
And it is an extremely awesome show if you've never seen it before. It's very similar to The Twilight Zone. It is Alfred Hitchcock introduces the story, and then it goes into a story of some sort, whether it be a murder or suspense or thriller or something along those lines. He is one of the first people to also acknowledge how good television could be as a storytelling method.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things about Psycho is that it was considered to be an Alfred Hitchcock Presents
yeah.
episode at one point after yeah. he had finished filming.
Yeah, he was
not
getting
even,
jittery.
Yeah, not even like, oh, maybe we should do this as an episode instead.
Yeah.
This movie almost got cut down to only be an hour long and just pretty much be through the shower scene and then end.
Yeah, I
like,
mean...
that would have been insane. So let's get into some specifics about Psycho. So it is based on the novel by Robert Bloch. Robert Bloch was a protege of H.P. Lovecraft, which is super cool. When he was a teenager, he actually mailed Lovecraft personally to ask if he could get some of Lovecraft's older work. Lovecraft was so impressed that he actually sent some of his personal collection to Bloch.
Wow.
So he's beginning to kind of form this relationship with one of the great sci-fi writers of all time.
Yeah.
Lovecraft's Haunter in the Dark is a sequel to one of Bloch's stories, and he also reworked a character to more closely resemble Bloch. He kills Bloch, and not only that, but this story is integral in Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Bloch is actually a pretty important figure in all of literature history, especially
and
sci-fi and
if
horror.
If you were to call Alfred Hitchcock the father of modern horror cinema, H.P. Lovecraft is, you know, him and I guess Poe are the fathers of modern horror literature. So it's kind of a really big deal.
And while Bloch tried to be more of a sci-fi writer, he published stuff in Weird Tales,
mm-hmm.
he won a Hugo Award for Hellbound Train,
mm-hmm.
he hears about the story about this guy named Ed Gein.
Mm-hmm. And Ed Gein is a very creepy serial killer. He's living in this area. Where exactly is it located?
He was living in Wisconsin.
Wisconsin, yeah. So there's a small town in Wisconsin, and there's kind of this creepy guy that is a little bit off, and he lives with his mother, and he just sort of roams around, and everyone thinks he's kind of like that slow, you know, guy that's kind of nice to everyone, and no one really, you know, kind of considers him to be a very intimidating individual. And so in this time period, things like this don't happen, especially in these rural towns. So Ed Gein had been looking through obituaries, digging up the graves and mutilating the corpses.
He exhumed somewhere around like 40 bodies.
Yeah. So, and it wasn't until, you know, he only actually killed 2 women, Mary Hogan and Bernice Worden. And he would, so let's just go over some of the creepy stuff that he did, because I find it interesting. I'm kind of into true crime.
It's super, super creepy, but it is informative.
Yes, it's
actually really informative for
cinema.
All horror movies.
Yeah, a lot of horror movies. So he built an entire woman's bodysuit from these women, and he would wear it around, complete with an entire frontal vest of women, and a face that he would put on his own head, and he said he would dance around as a woman with all of this bodysuit that he would wear. He made upholstered chairs of human body parts. One of the most fascinating and creepy things that he had this nipple belt. So he created a belt of nipples, and he just, I don't know where you would wear that, you know? So, but yeah,
that's good, Ryan.
Yeah, I guess that's good. I'm not relating enough to Ed Gein to want to wear the nipple belt, so that's good. Yeah, I don't know how much detail we should go into, but at this time, they didn't go into any detail. The newspapers would not go into detail because it was seen as not stomachable by the American population, not wanting to be put in the newspapers or anything like that. But the thing about Ed Gein is that, especially in the horror genre, so many horror movies have come from the story of Ed Gein.
100%.
The first tracked, found, and reported serial killer. So Gein actually is the inspiration for mostly Leatherface, which is Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He's that true story that they talk about is actually Ed Gein. A lot less exciting and blood splattery, but the fact that it's the Leatherface is wearing a woman's bodysuit that he created from the people that he had killed kind of came from that. And also Buffalo Bill and Silence of the Lambs is also inspired by Ed Gein as well.
Yeah, so you've got three iconic horror villains all are derived from a single person.
Yeah.
And there's a lot more than that as well. I mean, you can look to American Psycho.
Yes.
And he was truly the first person to really horrify the nation in this fashion. Yeah, it's pretty gross in the things that Gein does.
Yes.
and so Block was also paid $6,750 for the screen rights to the book. That is before taxes. He was given no points, so he never received another dime after the film was released. This would be a total ripoff. What he thought was a fair amount of money, he had never had that much. He was working as a waiter at the time. He did not know it was Alfred Hitchcock who was bidding on his book. It was through a blind bid. He basically made no money for selling the story that would become one of the most iconic horror movies ever made.
So I don't know if he's still alive, but if you want to support Robert Bloch, he definitely deserves it. So you can actually buy his book still. So
after the book is bought, Alfred Hitchcock begins to push to make this movie. He owns the rights, so he's the only person who can make it. The studio thought he was an insane person when he brought it to them. Paramount was who he was contracted to make the next movie with. They wanted something like North by Northwest. He brings them this insane story about murder, and they're like, what is going on? Mm-hmm. They've never even heard anything like this. There's no way they can even put it on film. And yet this is the story that he wants to tell.
Yeah.
And again, he's at his absolute peak.
He can write anything.
He can do pretty much anything.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that he does is after buying the rights to the movie, he bought every single copy of the book that was in print just so he could keep the plot hidden.
Yeah.
There was only, like, I believe it was like 6,000 copies of the book out. Mm. And he bought all of them. It wasn't that many.
Yeah. So Robert Bloch got a little bit of a quick payout there, too. So.
It's true.
Yeah.
So Hitchcock senses his secretaries had to go buy all the stuff. They do it. Paramount does decide that they're willing to produce the film, but only after Lou Wasserman, who is one of the most important figures in all of Hollywood history. He helps with Universal Studios, making it one of the biggest studios in the world at the time. He was Alfred Hitchcock's agent. And so he comes into a meeting with Paramount and says, hey, Hitchcock is going to direct this movie for free. Normally, Alfred Hitchcock would receive $250,000 to direct a movie. So they're like, okay.
Yeah, what's the inflation on that? Do you have it in front of you?
I do not have that in front of me.
Okay.
But it would be probably somewhere in like the $2 million range of the movie.
Yeah.
Something along those lines.
Yeah.
In return for that, Alfred Hitchcock wants 60% of the negative, which in turn means he owns 60% of the film outright. So for every dollar that is made on the movie, he gets 60 cents.
So he's basically just betting it all on Alfred Hitchcock right now.
Yes. On top of that, he would help self-finance the movie. He was able to get together a bunch of investors. A common misunderstanding about Alfred Hitchcock making this movie is that he mortgaged his house. He did not mortgage his house. He was able to get the money in other fundraising ways. But it's a fun story that people tell.
Yeah.
And then in return, Paramount would distribute. And so to them, there was basically zero risk involved. They weren't putting up any money. They were just saying, we'll go ahead and release this movie. And if it bombs, we pretty much just paid for the marketing materials to put it out into theaters and paid to send out the prints. That's essentially all they paid for.
Yeah.
And then they would get about 40% of the profits. Mm-hmm. So for them, this was a no-brainer. They're like, okay, sure.
Yeah.
We'll absolutely do this.
As long as their name wasn't on the project, because they just found it so grotesque and awful.
Yeah, as long as they weren't the ones actually spending the money to make it to get made, they could just say, oh, well, it was Alfred Hitchcock. We said he would release one of his movies, so we did.
Yeah, so the budget was about $800,000, which in today's money is about $6.6 million, which is nothing. That is a low budget film today. It was shot in black and white to save the money, and shot on a spare set on the Universal lot using the Alfred Hitchcock Presents crew.
Yeah, there are a couple people of note that worked on the movie, but for the most part, this is a super low budget movie. This is like a Blumhouse style release.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So, I mean, Blumhouse maxes at like $6 million for their budgets.
Yeah.
This one costs 6.6.
Go over that budget. They will not go over it. If you want to do anything over that $6 million, they make you go finance it yourself.
Yep. So that is the situation that we're in. The cast starts to get assembled. The first person he goes to is Anthony Perkins. Anthony Perkins is a Broadway star. He's very good friends with Stephen Sondheim. One of his friends named Paul Jasmine would make crank calls.
Yes.
And for some reason, Anthony Perkins played one of these crank calls for Alfred Hitchcock.
Mm-hmm.
And immediately Alfred Hitchcock's like, hey, I need to get that guy.
Well, and he played like a woman character. So he was like, oh, yes, that's interesting.
Yeah. So he's like, huh, I like how your friend can do the voice of a woman so well.
Yeah.
Can I get a meeting with him?
Yeah.
And Paul Jasmine is one of the three people used to create the voice of Mrs. Bates.
Mm-hmm.
The most important person cast in the movie is Janet Leigh. She was one of the biggest actresses in the world at the time. After Psycho, she goes on to make Bye Bye Birdie and a bunch of other movies. And so the reason why Janet Leigh was so important is that they wanted to make sure that audiences would be drawn into her character from the word go. And again, Alfred Hitchcock is very well known for making movies with young women at this time. Eve Marie Saint was the woman who just had been in North by Northwest. He also worked extensively with Grace Kelly, with so many different women throughout the years. I mean, it's one of Alfred Hitchcock's trademarks is working with all of these young women at the time. And so, of course, they want to cast one of the biggest stars in the world.
So
the reason why it's so important is because – go ahead.
So, sorry. So just for like our listeners, what's like a modern equivalent to Jennifer Leigh at this time? Would it be like a J-Law, even though she's kind of fallen off a little bit? But would that be
– It would, though. It would be something like Jennifer Lawrence.
Wow.
I mean, the next movie to do something like this is Scream.
Mm.
When they murdered Drew Barrymore at the beginning of the movie.
Yeah.
It is because, hey, Drew Barrymore's a huge star.
Yeah.
They even put Drew Barrymore on the cover of that movie.
Wow.
To help people believe that she was going to be a big part of the movie. Then they murdered her.
Wow.
It's a reference to Psycho.
Yeah.
And that's part of what they did. Like, Drew Barrymore was one of the it girls of the 1990s.
Mm-hmm.
Janet Leigh was one of the it girls of the 1950s.
Yeah.
And so to cast somebody that big and then murder them would be a huge deal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he was able to kind of sell it to her and make it an interesting role for her.
Mm-hmm.
But the studio insisted that he put him in the movie. Mm-hmm. Another woman that was involved who played Lila was Vera Miles. Hitchcock thought she was going to be a superstar, thought she was going to be the next Grace Kelly. That did not end up coming to pass. However, she took on this role to help pay off her contract deal with Paramount and with Hitchcock, so they were able to make it work. So that assembles the core cast of this movie. And then some other important people were also involved behind the scenes. One of the big ones is Saul Bass. He did all of the credit sequences for all of the Hitchcock movies. But one of the things that he's best known for is actually making various logos. He made the Girl Scout logo, the AT&T logo, Getty Images logos.
Okay.
He would also make posters for The Shining, for Vertigo, for Anatomy of a Murder. Saul Bass is one of the most distinctive styles of art of anybody in the world in the 1950s, and Alfred Hitchcock gives him a little bit more to do on this film than he does on previous films. He also has him start to storyboard out a shower scene. And then there's one more person that's really important in the overall success of Psycho, and that is Bernard Herrmann.
Yeah, Bernard Herrmann is the individual that scored the movie Psycho. And he also scored Citizen Kane, Taxi Driver, The Day the Earth Stood Still. And the biggest thing about this movie is that they were going back and forth, Alfred Hitchcock and Bernard, about like what he, because Alfred Hitchcock wanted no score. He wanted it to
no music.
Be complete drama and nothing else. And so Bernard was like, well, what about if we just do strings? So that whole like, eek, 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 you know, that's iconic with Psycho, is Bernard. And actually Alfred Hitchcock, when he finally saw the shower scene for the first time and the score was placed with it, he went up to Bernard and shook his hand and he said, "Sir, you've saved my movie."
Yeah, I mean, even later, he says that 33% of the effect of Psycho is the music.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, that is – it's really big, so – and just going back to Sam Loomis, it was really funny because Alfred Hitchcock thought he was so boring and so stoic that most of the shots with Sam Loomis are actually from behind his head. So that he's not really in most of the shots. It's mostly shot from behind
his head. It doesn't really matter he's in the movie. Yeah. Sam Loomis is the most unimportant character of the core characters of this movie.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it is. I love just his brashness. He's like, "I'm Alfred Hitchcock. You want him in this movie? Fine. But, like, I'm going to do what I want with him."
So the movie begins production. It lasts about 4 months. I forgot to write down the exact time. I believe it was from November of 1959 to February of 1960. Hitchcock kind of needs to start building buzz immediately. So one of the things that he does is he allows a leak of photos where different people are sitting in a director's chair that says Mrs. Bates on the back. He wants to make sure that people realize how important this character is without giving away who will play this character. And so there's pictures of Hitchcock in the seat. There's pictures of Vivian Leigh and everybody in the movie except for Anthony Perkins. The whole movie is actually done very, very secretive. He makes the entire cast swear that they are not going to spill any of the secrets. It is important to Hitchcock that nobody knows what is going on in this movie. There are some really fun stories about kind of the production of what was happening in the movie that kind of leaked out over the years. One of them is about Jerry Mathers.
So, yeah, Jerry Mathers is the child star of Leave It to Beaver, and he actually helped make the corpse for Mrs. Bates. They were all shot on the same Universal Studio. Studio, I guess, lot, yeah? So, yeah.
At the time, they were all shot on, like, studio lots. It's like Leave It to Beaver were next to each other.
Yeah, so basically they used the same makeup artist, Robert Don. So Don brought in Mathers to help him create the hair on the top of the skull of Mrs. Bates. So he had to glue it on one at a time.
Yeah, what, just little pieces of hair.
Yeah, exactly. So Mathers actually wrote later, "As a young boy, I thought, what could be cooler than this? Just glowing on the hairs to this, like, corpse."
Yeah, I just love the idea of Beaver. So yeah. Leave It to Beaver helped make this super grisly thing.
Yeah, exactly.
And I believe the only reason why it happened is because Hitchcock already knew Mathers from Troubled Harry. Okay, so Ryan, let's go ahead and start talking about the most important scene in the whole movie, probably one of the most important scenes in the history of cinema,
yes.
And that is the shower scene.
Absolutely. So one of the biggest things is that it was shot over the course of 7 days. They got this lady, because Janet Leigh obviously was this high-end, very prestigious actress. She didn't want to be doing this nude scene. So they got this lady, Marley Renfro, who was the cover of Playboy in September of 1960.
Which is the same month that Psycho comes out, actually.
Oh, interesting. So, yep. So some of the shots are her skin, but some of the others are actually Lee.
When people ask Hitchcock why he does the movie, his response is I think that the thing that appealed to me and made me decide to do the picture was the suddenness of the murder in the shower.
Mm.
So, Alfred Hitchcock reads over this scene and it hooks him. And that's the whole reason that this movie gets made.
So, yeah, one of the things about horror is taking places that you feel safe and secure and making you uncomfortable and queasy. So they do it with The Collector, where he booby traps your house and you're trapped in your own home. So there's so many people after seeing Psycho that they never feel secure in the shower again. So,
well, I mean, and one of those people is Janet Leigh.
Mm.
Janet Leigh would notoriously not take showers. Wow. After this movie, after she saw herself get murdered on screen, because she was scared to go back in showers.
Wow.
She would take baths for most of the rest of her life.
Wow.
Which is an amazing fact, considering that she had to spend 7 days
yeah.
in and out of a
Being
shower.
Being murdered in a shower.
And so when you actually see Mrs. Bates emerge on screen for the first time, it is not Anthony Perkins. A lot of people make this mistake. Anthony Perkins was actually on Broadway performing a show while they had to film the scene. So it's actually a stunt woman who's got black makeup all over her face, so you can't see her. That was an important point, because it also helps kind of misdirect you later in the movie when it comes to the big reveal that Norman is Norma. The total scene lasts 52 seconds long. There are 78 cuts in this scene.
Yeah.
Something like this had never been done before.
Mm-hmm.
Most scenes would run for 5-6 minutes. There'd be continuous shots. Maybe they would do a couple to kind of move around the room a little bit. Funny enough, Alfred Hitchcock made a movie called Rope that notoriously only has a few cuts, period.
Wow.
The whole movie looks like it's a single shot. Cuts were not a common thing in movies anyway.
Wow, interesting.
And all of a sudden, he's jamming in 70 of them quicker than 1 per second.
Yeah.
Before you can even realize what you are watching, it is already moving on to the next image. So they're making all these quick cuts, and part of the reason for some of the additional cuts, originally they had planned for, like, I believe it was 75. They added a couple for here and there.
Okay.
One of them is because Janet Leigh took a breath during the scene where she's actually dead on the ground. It's very, very slight. But Alma says, hey, you cannot release this.
Yeah.
If you release this, then the whole movie's going to be ruined because of this one breath.
Yeah.
So rather than leave that in there, they cut back to the shower one more time and then cut back to her body, and then the camera moves away. It's an immaculate scene.
Mm-hmm.
It's so important in the history of cinema. There's actually a documentary that I encourage you all to watch called 7852. It's on Hulu.
Mm-hmm.
It's about an hour and a half long, and it's just about this scene.
Wow.
And it's broken down frame by frame.
Wow.
It is incredible. One of the most important moments in the history of all of cinema. It's showing a woman basically naked.
Yeah.
It's so grisly. Janet Leigh gets murdered. Nobody had ever seen anything like this before in a film. Is
yeah.
so iconic.
Yeah.
It just, this scene is so important.
No, I mean, the another thing about this scene is that, like, in every cinema big moment montage, it's going to be there. It's
yeah.
going to be in that montage. You've seen this scene before, a portion of it at least, because it's just so important. It's so groundbreaking, And we'll talk about why it's groundbreaking, because the censors did not want it in the movie.
Basically at all.
Yeah.
When you see a hand, that hand is Alfred Hitchcock's. Mm-hmm. Something also that's super important is that the bathroom is extremely clean. Mm-hmm. Hitchcock was a Victorian, and he believed that white tile and clean bathrooms were super important. Mm-hmm. And so he had a fascination with bathrooms. It goes back to The Lodger, to Blackmail. A bunch of his other films actually feature the bathroom, which is why this drew him to the movie so much. Mm-hmm. He had long envisioned having a grisly murder in a bathroom, and here is the opportunity.
The opportunity. Perfect. He read this book, and he's like, this. They actually used Bosco chocolate syrup for the blood, because the red blood wouldn't show up in black and white. So it's actually chocolate syrup slowly going down the drain of the shower there. Yep. So Bob Bourne, he went out and bought all these different types of melons. So he had watermelons, cassavas, cantaloupes, honeydew, and Hancock would just sit there, close his eyes, and have different crew members just stabbing these melons over and over to try to get just the right sound. So when he'd open his eyes, they were covered in fruit gore, and said the cassava. They mixed the sound of the stabbing with the cassava and the stabbing of a steak to create the sound for the movie.
It's okay. It's cassava. No big deal.
Cassava, whatever. Names are not my thing. I'm not here to pronounce names.
The important thing is they used a melon and steak and blended those noises together.
What is a cassava? I don't even know what that is.
Now we have to talk about how the movie actually gets released. So the movie gets made. They wrap. Everything's feeling good. But there were a lot of things that kind of stood in the way at the time. So we kind of have to talk about the Hays Production Code. Now, the Hays Production Code was a self-imposed set of rules that Hollywood had put on themselves to make sure that the government would not censor movies. They started doing this in the 1930s. 37 states already had 100 censorship bills introduced in their state legislatures by 1921.
Wow.
They just didn't want government interference in making movies. Mm-hmm. So the code was basically two big parts. The first part was that a movie would have general principles, that it would not lower the moral standards of those who watched it.
Mm.
Pretty reasonable.
Yeah.
The second one was particular applications of things could not be shown. So this basically meant you couldn't have affairs. There was no interracial relationships. Mm. This was super restrictive, super conservative.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason for that is because it was heavily inspired by the Catholic Church.
Mm.
In fact, the entire code was co-written by a Jesuit preacher and a Catholic editor of the Motion Picture Herald.
Mm.
So the two people together helped write this code, and it was super enforced over the years. That's why in Casablanca you don't have a sex scene between Rick and Ilsa, because it wasn't allowed.
Interesting.
Sex scenes basically could not exist through the 1960s in film because of the Hays Production Code. And this also meant that movies didn't really get ratings yet. Mm. Ratings weren't introduced for a little bit longer until the MPAA started doing them. And so, as a result, a lot of these films are just that you see that are older don't have ratings at all.
Interesting.
Yep.
So Psycho, that first rule, just to dig into it a little bit, that it had to not lower the moral standards. Bad guys at the end of movies had to be caught. There is no American gangster, you know, or all these crime movies where they're kind of Breaking Bad. You know what I mean? I guess he ends up, you know, but.
Well, and death is also very quick.
Yeah.
We couldn't see long, drawn-out deaths with characters in anguish.
Yeah.
It was they got shot, and they were instantly dead.
Yeah.
You didn't have characters get shot, stick it out for long periods of time, and bleed all over. Like, you didn't have Reservoir Dogs.
Yeah.
What would never have been a thing in the Hays Code.
Yeah, interesting.
Because it would have signaled, like, if you're getting shot, you're a bad guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Like you said, the code was extremely restrictive on movies.
Interesting.
And there's a lot of interesting ways in which it's subverted, but it was still restrictive in what actually was put on screen. So obviously, Psycho has some issues, a lot of issues with the code. Now, the Production Code Administration, or PCA, were the people who would watch the movies and say whether or not a movie was approved. So they would show the movies to a board of five people. The first time they showed the shower scene to a board of five people, three of the five censors said they saw nudity, two of them said they didn't.
I love this story.
Immediately, Hitchcock's like, well, we're keeping this in the movie. So he takes back the film, says he's going to edit it. He sends it back unedited, doesn't change anything. And this time, the two people that said they didn't see nudity say they do, but the three censors who said they saw nudity do not. So that everybody just flips their votes. Mm-hmm. So he just keeps sending it. He never makes a cut at all in the entire sequence. He just keeps sending it until they're eventually like, okay, I guess we'll put this on.
Yeah, he just keeps saying, okay, I've removed the nudity. It's ready to go.
Fun fact, there is some nudity if yes. you're really, really looking for it. But... again, 78 cuts
yeah.
in 52 seconds. If it shows, it happens extremely quickly.
You get a real quick sneaky nip.
yeah, and then there's another thing that the opening scene really drew a lot of anger because a woman had never been in a bra before. This was scandalous. Mm-hmm. How are they going to handle this? Hitchcock's like, you know what? I've already made all my changes to the other scene. If you leave the shower scene as is, I will change the scene with her in the bra if you come to set and show me how to direct it. Mm-hmm. So they all show up that day, they get ready to do the scene again, and the censors never showed up. Just straight up never came. Yeah. And so they're like, okay, I guess that means we get to keep it in the movie. Yeah. They kept it in the movie. Yeah, Hitchcock is really, really pushing back against the censors with this movie, mm-hmm. and he's able to get everything through that he wants.
Yeah, he got everything that he wanted. He didn't censor one bit of his movie.
Yep. So the next big important thing is that people actually have to go see this movie. Mm-hmm. And that's why this is one of the cool things about Psycho is the way in which they marketed the
movie. Yeah. So actually we talked about in the Hereditary review or look back that we did, horror movies especially are starting to advertise in a similar way that Hitchcock was advertising this movie. The entire trailer for this movie had no scenes from the movie. There was no scenes from the movie.
Zero.
There were portions of the behind the scenes, Hitchcock, but no scenes from the movie were actually used.
He actually just did a tour of the set and showed all the important locations and explained important things about it and then never actually showed it. The trailer was 6 minutes.
Holy crap. Okay. That's interesting. I did not know that.
And one of the important things about it is that it also announced a very new, innovative policy for the movie.
Yes. So the one thing about this movie is that during this time in cinema, there were no start times for movies. There wasn't a time where you should show up and come to the movies. If you wanted to go see a movie, you paid the ticket man the money to go see the movie, and you walked in. No matter when the movie was going on, you just sort of walked in. And it was kind of why these B-rate movies were kind of being produced at that time, because anyone could walk in at any time and you kind of had to be able to sell it to an audience without knowing beginning or middle and just seeing the end. You had to be like, oh, that was a good experience. So Hitchcock actually required that the movie theaters have a hard start time. You could not enter the theater after the movie had started. And this to audiences was seen as rude. It was rude for them to be – for Hitch, how dare he tell us when we can go see a movie. But the ad read, it is required that you see Psycho from the very beginning. We won't allow you to cheat yourself. Every theater manager everywhere has been instructed to admit no one after the start of each performance of Psycho. We said no one, not even the manager's brother, the President of the United States, or the Queen of England. God bless her.
It's an amazing It's absolutely amazing.
So, and only Alfred Hitchcock at this time could get away with something like this. There's no one else that at this time could do this. So it was pretty incredible that he took another risk with the American audience and was willing to insult them to be able to market it in this way.
Yeah, and I mean, and one of the big reasons for that too is that the shower scene
yes.
doesn't matter if you don't watch the hour and a half the hour prior
yeah.
to it. You also don't realize if you walked into a movie 3/4 of the way through mm-hmm. and was like, wait, I thought this was a Janet Leigh picture
yes.
and then she never shows up. That would be a little weird.
Yeah.
And so Hitchcock basically structured the movie so that you buy in on the original premise
yes.
that this movie is about a woman who steals money and whether or not she's going to get caught, because this had been a trope in a lot of other Hitchcock movies. Mm-hmm. Somebody does a crime, you're trying to see whether or not they're going to get away with it or not. He did it in Rope, he did it in a bunch of different films. And so now, that's what you think this movie's about.
Yeah.
And then she gets viciously murdered
yes.
in the shower scene an hour in, and everyone was like, what did I just watch?
Yeah. And you know, another thing is that he marketed it not to tell people the ending. It's so important you don't tell people the ending. Because the ending was this big twist that he went out on a limb to make sure that nobody knew it.
Yeah, it was insane.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely crazy. Mm-hmm. So the movie comes out. Critics are a little weary
yes.
on it. One person was so angry that she walked out halfway through the movie after the murder and quit her job. That is a real thing that a critic did after watching Psycho.
God, that's so
thought
funny.
That what she had just watched was so smutty and terrible that she never wanted to be a movie critic ever again.
Yeah.
But then some kind of were like, what Hitchcock's doing here is super revolutionary. Mm-hmm. Maybe we should pay attention to it.
Yeah.
And so the critics have a mixed to strong response. However, when audiences see it, everything changes.
Yeah, so it made about $50 million worldwide. Adjusted for inflation, it would have made about $390 million domestically. So to put that in perspective, that's more than Deadpool made in 2016.
Yeah, it's an insane amount of money
yeah.
that this movie makes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, again, this is all just domestic. So it is raking in the cash.
So and to put it all into perspective, that no one wanted this movie made. Everyone said it was going to fail. People were betting on this movie not doing well. One of his crew members actually took a raise instead of getting pieces of this movie because they were just like, I don't know why he's doing it. This is insane.
Yeah. Instead of getting a percent of the gross,
yeah.
took on like a 50 cent an hour raise.
Mm-hmm.
Not even.
Yeah.
Because this was 1960.
Yeah.
It was probably like 10 cents an hour raise.
Yeah.
Insane.
Yeah.
And despite the crazy reaction that audiences give to it, it becomes an international phenomenon
mm-hmm.
immediately. The movie gets 4 Oscar nominations. It gets Best Director for Alfred Hitchcock, Best Supporting Actress for Lee, Best Cinematography, and Best Art Direction. It did not win a single Oscar. The Apartment would win Best Picture. Psycho was not nominated for Best Picture. And Alfred Hitchcock would lose Best Director. It would be the last time he would get nominated for Best Director at the Oscars in competition. Sadly, the movie goes home empty-handed.
Mm-hmm.
But obviously, 58 years later, it is an iconic film.
Iconic?
So it was...
And even with all the horror that's out here, with all the modern techniques that are done... It still stands the test of time. It's so good even today.
Let's run through some of the other cool fun facts about this movie.
Yeah.
We're going to read some quotes.
Yeah, we're going to read some quotes from Hitchcock. So in this one he has, in the opening of Psycho, I wanted to say that we were in Phoenix. And we even spelled out the day and the time. But I only did that to lead up to the very important fact that it was 2:43 in the afternoon, and this is the only time the poor girl has to go to bed with her lover. It also allows the viewer to become a peeping Tom.
I love that those two sentiments are expressed so closely together.
Yes.
The sex is an important part of this.
Yes.
But also it makes you feel bad for this woman.
Yeah.
That she is so poor and frustrated with her life.
Yes.
And all she wants to do is marry Sam.
Yeah.
And the entire plot of this movie is for her to steal money to be with the person she loves.
Yes.
That's what this movie is about.
Mm-hmm.
There are romantic comedies that begin exactly the same way as Psycho.
Yes.
Like, straight up.
And with a twist.
And then, and then this movie takes this horrifying turn.
Yes.
It really is sad, and I love the fact that he points that out.
No, absolutely. Yeah, so another one of his... Yeah, so the first part of the story was a red herring. That was deliberate to detach the viewer's attention in order to heighten the murder. we purposely made the beginning on the long side, with a bit about the theft and her escape, in order to get the audience absorbed with the question of whether she would or not be caught.
So one of the things that I love about the movie is that the question of what happened to the money literally never goes away.
Mm-hmm.
From start to finish of this movie, they keep bringing up the money, and it feels so trivial after mm-hmm. her murder. And yet it keeps coming back up. Ryan and I both obviously rewatched the movie before we did the episode.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a point in the movie where she's been dead for a while. And Lila and Sam go to the cops about Arbogast. And they're like, oh, Arbogast is dead. And he's like, are you sure he didn't just find the money and run away with it?
Like the money is still, the
theft of the money is still seen as more likely an issue in society than the murder of this girl.
Yeah. So, you know what? It really shows that it's a McGovern, right? I used that correctly?
Yeah, it does show that it's a McGovern. You did. And then even when Sam is questioning Norman back at the hotel, right before he goes up and he tries to kill Lila, their last little tussle begins because they're talking about the $40,000. And Norman literally has no idea what they're talking about.
Interesting.
So all the way until the end, it's the hunt for the money that ultimately reveals everything in the movie.
Mm-hmm.
A couple other cool quotes. Why didn't they go to the police? I've always replied, they don't go to the police because it's dull. It's very true.
Yeah, it is.
when they go to the police aren't helpful.
Yeah.
And it's one of the only movie, it's a common thing that you hear as a horror fan that always frustrates me about these movies. Is people are like, well, yeah, if this happened, I would just leave. I'm like, yeah, but then there's no story.
It's a movie.
So I love that Alfred Hitchcock's like, oh, the police suck.
Yeah.
I'm going to make the police suck. And that is actually a theme through Hitchcock movies.
Interesting.
Is that policemen, because remember, it is only policemen.
Yes. Oh, goodness.
Policemen are incompetent across all of his movies.
Interesting.
That's important to him.
Yeah.
So
that's important to him.
And then another fun little quote from him. He goes, when a burglar goes into the room, all the time he's going through the drawers, the public is generally anxious for him. And this is important because as the movie shifts perspectives, you grow anxious for different characters. First, you grow anxious for Marion Crane. She steals the money. You're anxious she's going to get caught. Is she going to get caught? I don't know. Then later in the movie, after Norman kills her, you're like, oh my God, is he going to successfully hide the body? I don't know. The simple act of him trying to hide the body is a crime, even if he's not the one who committed it. That would still have been a crime. It turns out, obviously, he did murder
her. Yeah.
But throughout each step of the movie, we're presented with different people who have done something wrong, and you're hoping they get away with it. Even Lila, at the very end, breaks and enters into this woman, into Norman's house, and then get the general reveal. This movie is full of people committing crimes and getting punished for committing those crimes.
Interesting.
It is an interesting concept that Hitchcock is working with through the entire movie.
So this is the first movie ever to show a toilet flushing.
Toilet, period.
A toilet in general.
Yes.
They don't show a toilet at – wow, okay. Because I know – so they not only do they show the toilet, they also showed it functioning. Really pushing the envelope here. So Janet Lee's daughter, Jamie Lee Curtis, turned one during the shooting of Psycho. And Jamie Lee Curtis is also an iconic horror character as well, and she plays Laurie Shroud in the Halloween film series, which we're going to talk about next because it takes so much from Psycho, which is kind of cool that Jamie Lee Curtis is, one of the main characters in the movie. So
kind of tying back to Halloween immediately, we're going to talk about the car that Janet Lee drives.
Mm-hmm.
It's a 1957 Ford sedan. It was the same car that was actually used as the family car in Leave It to Beaver. Crazy fact. Borrowed a lot of things from that set.
Yeah.
And then the car would actually show up again in the 1998 film Halloween H2O. It was the franchise headlined by Jamie Lee Curtis.
Wasn't it the exact same car, too, they actually found?
The exact same car, yes. And Lee not only appears in the movie, her character name is Norma.
Mm.
Pretty cool.
Mm-hmm.
Something that happened in 1959 that was kind of important during the filming of this movie, actually. The Clutter family, which is a family of four, was murdered by Dick Hickok and Perry Smith on November 15th. their case would become well known around the world when Truman Capote released his book in 1964 called In Cold Blood. It was one of the great true crime novels ever made. So In Cold Blood is an amazing book, an amazing movie. Check it out if you have.
Mm-hmm. Another quick fact, the film was inducted into the Library of Congress for cultural preservation in 1992. It's the first horror film to receive the honor, and it was inducted the same year as The Birth of a Nation, Bonnie and Clyde, and Annie Hall, which obviously from totally different genres, you can see how iconic all those movies are.
Yeah, it was the fourth ever class for the Library
wow,
of Congress.
Wow, that's awesome.
It also appears on a lot of the AFI lists. It was originally 18th in the top 100 movies ever made. When they did the 10-year anniversary edition of the top 100 movies ever made, it climbed to 14th. It is number one on the all-time thrills list by AFI. Norman Bates is the number two villain on the list, only to Hannibal Lecter in Silence of the Lambs. A Boy's Best Friend is His Mother was the 56th quote. And the movie's score was also ranked the fourth best score of all time by AFI. And Alfred Hitchcock would make about $15 million personally off the original gross of the film.
That's not inflated, right?
That is not inflated. That's $15 million of that time.
Okay. That's awesome.
So again, we already said $800,000 was equal to $6.6 million today. So let's pretend 15 times 7, he made like $70 million by making this movie.
So, and he didn't mortgage his home, so.
And he didn't mortgage his home. Yeah. He really came out on top.
Yeah. So the remains of Miss Bates are in the, oh God, why did you give me this fact?
It's okay. I'll take it.
Okay.
The remains of Mrs. Bates are held in the Musée du Cinéma at La Cinémathèque in Paris. Yeah. Very, very French.
Yeah.
He thought that an American museum would just lose it. So he wanted to make sure somebody who cared about movies would take care of it.
Oh my God. He's so pretentious. I love it. Okay.
Yes.
The movie didn't receive an R rating because, as we talked about earlier, the MPAA didn't have rating systems back in the day. So they went back and gave him the R rating in 1984. Alfred Hitchcock was one of the first directors known for making a cameo in his movies. He does so in Psycho when Marion returns to work. He's outside her office wearing a cowboy hat.
Yeah.
So he's the M. Night Shyamalan of that era.
I was like, he did it years before. Everybody else is just copying.
Yeah, exactly. Or homage to Alfred Hitchcock.
The film is set in December because Christmas decorations were visible in the background shots used by second units throughout the movie. There was like, oh, I guess we have to do this now. Just a couple other last influences. Martin Scorsese recreated the scene shot for shot when shooting Raging Bull. He structured the fight between Jack LaMotta, played by Robert De Niro, and Sugar Ray Robinson, Johnny Barnes, to be cut exactly the same way. So he broke it down shot for shot and then reassembled it as a fight scene. Super cool. And then it also influenced scenes in The Conversation by Francis Ford Coppola. Alfred Hitchcock would go on to make The Birds in 1963, Marnie in 1964, capping off his historic run as a director. He would make a couple more films, including Family Plot, which would be his last film in 1976. He would pass away from renal failure in 1980. Since then, Alfred Hitchcock has become an icon and a legend around. Psycho is both his absolute career peak and also kind of the beginning of his eventual downfall as a director. It is this extremely special movie that I will always continue to love it and cherish it for what it is.
No, absolutely. It's literally the father of modern horror. This is why we started on this movie.
We just have a couple more questions from other people.
Oh, wow, we actually got some questions real quick.
We had a couple questions. One of them we already kind of answered a little bit, but we'll go ahead and shout it out. Matthew Burdett asks, does this movie still hold up in 2018? The answer is yes. I think that when you go into it with the context knowing that it what it is, I believe that it does still hold up, and at bare minimum, the shower scene is incredible, even by today's standards. There may be no more brilliantly shot sequence than that one in the history of all of movie, and to use montage so effectively to tell a story so quickly is still unparalleled. I do believe that the second half of the movie does not hold up as well as the first half.
Yeah,
and that's just because the movie kind of turns a little bit. It has to embrace the violence, and that scene is so iconic that it's impossible to live up to that moment.
Yeah, that's definitely true.
I think
Let's talk. There's a couple. I mean, the end sequence is amazing. That's another iconic scene where it zooms in on his face, and he's speaking in his own narrative about madness. Yes, I wouldn't harm a fly.
Yes, that scene is still incredible. Yes. I would also argue that I think as soon as they leave the cop's house to the end of the movie is excellent. Okay. I think that the psychologist scene is necessary. It doesn't feel necessary today. It feels like we could probably have picked it all up on our own. But again, there had been nothing like this before in the history of cinema, let alone like something that people actually knew about. Remember, Ed Gein, the story only came out in 1952. They don't even begin hunting for sequence killers, as was the first term used to hunt serial killers, until the late 1960s.
Mm-hmm. Mindhunter.
Mindhunter. So, I mean, this is something super unique at the time, and so they need the psychologist to come in and explain that stuff away. I do think that the stuff between Arbogast's death and when they show up at the motel to try to trick Norman, it really drags. You could almost cut all of that out. If they had just gone straight there from Arbogast's house.
Yeah.
Or from when Arbogast tells Sam, like, I'm going to be back, and then he doesn't show up. If they had gone straight there through the end of the movie, I think that it would be a perfect horror film. But that middle part is necessary to help set up the importance that the audience finds out that Norma is dead. And that's why that part's there. So I really do think that Psycho holds up today. I really do believe it.
I think you can watch it right now and you would be entertained.
And especially compared to other movies from this era that are not as rewatchable. There are a lot of movies that are not very rewatchable from the 1950s and 60s. I love them, but I'm also not the majority of people. I totally understand. Like, I try to get Rachel to watch like oldies, and she's like,
I'm glad you've never asked me to watch them.
I mean, like, there's some really great movies from the 1950s and 60s, but I understand why people don't like it. It's why The West Wing was so popular. It was slow-paced. You didn't really have to pay super attention to it. Things happen. Like, and again, this goes back to the idea that you and I were talking about earlier, that because people would come and leave theaters, they would have to have these very long exposition-y scenes through the whole movie where you don't need that anymore because Psycho changed the game.
Yeah, and absolutely.
If you go into it with that knowledge, I think Psycho holds up without it, but I think having that knowledge makes it that much better and that much easier to appreciate. And then we got a couple questions from Aaron LeBlanc, who is my other co-host on the other podcast, We Bought a Pod. You are listening to the feed right now, so thank you. So the first question is, what part scared you the most?
Scared me. I mean, I would say that the most horrifying scene is the shower scene. You know, I mean, I think that there's a couple scenes in there that are meant to, we're just so desensitized nowadays, right? You know?
Yeah.
So, I mean, the scary parts, you know, are the revealing the mother's corpse and the, you know, I guess the most thrilling is where he's chasing her in the cellar dressed as his mother, right? And then, of course, the shower scene.
I think that the shower scene legitimately holds up today.
Yes.
I do think the scariest scene in the movie is when you get the first reveal when she turns Mrs. Bates and you see the skull. If you are somehow unaware of that twist before you go into that movie, that scene will give you a jump regardless.
Yeah.
And the way that she screams keys off other people to scream. I was lucky enough to see Psycho in a theater, and it actually elicited that response.
Really? Wow, that's awesome.
That people in the theater that I was in had apparently never seen it, and they screamed. So,
very cool.
And the same thing with the shower scene. Those scenes legitimately still scare people. So I think those are the pieces that are the best. What makes it so gosh darn iconic?
Well, the shower scene is just amazingly shot. It, like you said, it still holds up today. The sound, the score for the movie is amazing.
Yes.
And is continuously referenced in other movies throughout horror history. I'm sure AJ has a thousand other ways of, like, bringing it into play.
I mean, really, if we just want to break it down to why is it so gosh darn iconic, it comes down to the simple fact that it was able to influence an entire generation of movies. It invents the slasher film, which then becomes and I love how we've already talked about it a little bit on this podcast, that every 20 to 30 years is going to be a horror resurgence because people who are inspired by the last round of horror films come to prominence.
You can almost count it
15 years later, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre comes out and The Exorcist comes out. And boom, you have your first boom of horror. Yeah. If you count 20 years after Psycho, 25 years after Psycho, you get Nightmare on Elm Street. You get Friday the 13th movies.
Yes.
All these Halloween. Halloween. You get these movies start to pop up that are all 15, 20 years after the last run of after Psycho. Mm-hmm. And that gives the boom and sustains the genre and makes it relevant today. Like, those movies then inspire the next generation. And so that's why it's so iconic. And because, again, all of these things we talked about that had never been done before in a film all show up here first. Just like Hitchcock directed the first British talkie, he is reinventing the language of cinema on the fly in this movie. And then his last question, why is the remake so terrible?
I liked it. To be exact,
why is the remake so bad? But it's terrible. It is horrible. So here's the problem, is that, yes, it is shot for shot. You're 100% right. That is 90% of the issue right there. It's in color.
Yeah.
I happen to think that Gus Van Sant is an excellent director, and he was the worst person they could have put on this movie.
Yeah.
He had just come off of directing Good Will Hunting.
Yeah, they were saying,
Psycho,
I mean,
is not, like, the next obvious choice.
Yeah, they were saying he could have done anything at that point, and that's what he decided to do.
And the cast is, like, super dope, too. Yeah. I don't think people realize Vince Vaughn is Norman Bates, Anne Hesh is Marion Crane. I think that's also a problem. Anne Hesh was a deal, but she was not Marion Crane. Like, it would be like if they had gotten Julia Roberts to be...
Yeah, she's not Marion, yeah.
Like, to be Marion Crane. But she's Anne Hesh is not Janet Leigh. And I
love Vince Vaughn. I think he did a really good job of creeping me out. Like, so
he's fine. But he's honestly not as crazy a choice. Like, it was different, but it was fine.
You thought it would be crazy when I saw it. I was like, oh god, what is he doing it? But I thought he did a really good job of creeping me out and playing a totally different character than he normally would. But yeah, it is really bad. It's a shot for shot. Which is frustrating. Like, you're not going to do anything different or unique.
There's zero interesting, cool things that come out of it.
No, there's nothing new, nothing interesting, yeah.
I also think that doesn't help. That if you're making these kinds of movies, that there's a very fair conversation to be had that Silence of the Lambs had just come out, and this movie feels extremely tame compared to Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, geez.
Or even compared to Scream a year earlier. Like, this film worked in 1960 as the godfather of all movies. Horror movies.
Yeah.
But in 1998, like you said earlier, we've become desensitized to these things.
Yeah.
It's not as big of a deal as it once was.
Yeah, exactly. No, absolutely.
So, with all that said, we've given a pretty thorough breakdown on Psycho. Yeah. Fun fact, by the way, that actually means that this year, because Psycho came out, the remake came out in 1998, that we are officially celebrating the 20-year anniversary of the remake. Fun and interesting fact.
Yeah. Oh, God. Oh, that poor movie.
Is it a poor movie?
No. Yeah, you're right. It deserves all the hate it gets.
Yeah. So overall, you know, the movie is the original movie is amazing.
Yes,
we both love it, and we're going to be referencing it a lot in the future. So we wanted to make sure you guys knew a lot about the movie, and I think we've done that today. So if you guys have any other questions or other movies you'd like us to do in the future, go ahead and hit us up. We are available on Twitter as well as on Facebook. You hit us up on Twitter at We Bought a Blog, as well as at We Bought a Cabin in the Woods. We have both of those handles. We also have our brand spanking new Instagram at We Bought a Blog. You can go ahead and check us out there. We'll be posting things periodically on the Instagram, just kind of stuff that I am watching throughout the day. Ryan's watching, Aaron's watching, stuff like that. Definitely want to check that stuff out. You can hit us up on the Facebook page, like we said. You can ask us questions, hit us up on texts, whatever, or comment at the bottom of this post. We hope you enjoyed this, and we hope to keep bringing you awesome content with We Bought a Cabin in the Woods. And with that, I'm AJ.
And I'm Ryan. Keep it spooky.
Peace.